British Spy Stories, Season 1. Spy or Traitor? Episode 20. The windows of Murphy's office are witness to overnight raindrops that are now just a record of past events on the dry glass. He sits in an armchair, in a pool of light in one corner, an iPad in front of him. The fact that Stuart Palmer was highly active on the MI6 network in the period of time before Stranraer's death has been bouncing around in his skull for the last day. He had not even heard of Palmer before the news of his stabbing buzzed up from the light side of the embassy. He had heard nothing formally from London, and no spooks in Murphy's team knew about Palmer either. The man just appears to be a middle-ranking administrator doing something about trade. But that may just be a cover story, thinks Marcus. He needs to do something now that he has the traffic node data. He can't be seen to block it or be inactive. He flicks through Palmer's personal file. There really is nothing of consequence. No gap in years when he might have been turned by some foreign power. No posh education where he might have been approached in the pubs of an English town by a man of opaque origin. Murphy is used to assessing people, and his judgment is that either the data is wrong, or Palmer is the most effective undercover spy he has ever come across. When he had agreed to put Geraldine and Stuart in the safe house as a drop point for Alexander Keneally, the push had come from London. Murphy was happy to go along with it, but it seems odd now, in hindsight. Putting two untrained administrators in live field operations is high risk. But London had been adamant. Their rationale had been that Palmer was already considered to be a field ops agent by Alexander, and if they had told him to hand over information to an administrator, he would have been lost as a contact. And Murphy didn't have anyone else who was credible at the time. Agent Blackhawk disappearing exactly at the moment that Alexander was ready to talk had been unfortunate timing, but Murphy managed to recover the situation through comms to Alexander himself. Murphy's comms branch team had done a magnificent imitation of messages with the young man. Text messages, seemingly from Blackhawk, saying she had gone away to mourn the loss of her fictional boyfriend, and now he is ready to become their active source. This doesn't solve his Palmer problem. Murphy decides that the op can't be stopped, as Alexander is due to be given the safe house address today, and a win for Murphy in the current climate will be a boost for him. The killing of Stranraer on his territory still weighs on him. And more importantly, as far as Murphy's perception is concerned, the death is a big black mark against him from London's perspective. There is nothing he can do immediately about Palmer, and he will deal with him after Alexander has handed over the information. The wound from the attack a week ago is itching, and Hans tries not to scratch it, but his self-control collapses in the face of the discomfort, and he presses circles into his skin around the damage. Two women come in from the street and order coffee and cake, and he feels his phone vibrate 5 minutes later as he lays plates of Schwarzwälder Torte on the table in front of them. The device displays a notification indicating that Gabby has left a message on Site Carlo, and he leans on the back wall of the bar and logs in to the site. The message is direct and to the point. She is asking him to visit her flat in Berlin and upload the content of the USB stick that she left with him into the Oberon secure layer. Hans has access to normal Oberon in the Met bar so that he can make general inquiries of the system, but the secure functionality is only available in embassies and consulates, or in secure comms rooms like the one at Gabby's flat. Also, not all MI6 personnel have clearance for the secure layer. He knows that Black Hawk has only standard secret clearance, and top secret for the operations she is allocated onto, like all field ops personnel. Hans has top secret plus clearance, due to an operation near the Met Bar 3 years ago, when the BND and SIS had worked together to root out a cell of suicide bombers that would have devastated 4 sites in Berlin if they had not been infiltrated. Top Secret Plus gets him usefully into the highest level of Oberon security. After the lunchtime rush, he closes the Met Bar and walks alongside the river, then turns northwards towards the Moabit district of Berlin. It is mid-afternoon as he pushes open the door to her flat. He can immediately tell someone has been there. He has seen the place a few times before, and usually Gabrielle keeps it neat and tidy. Now it's a mess. Drawers hang out and their contents are strewn on the floor. In the kitchen, packets of pasta and cereal have been thrown across the space, and in the bedroom the duvet is in a large pile. All MI6 staff addresses are kept secret, as are safe houses and other operational buildings across the world. This isn't a random break-in. The TV and other saleable items are still in the apartment. Rarely is anything random where the security services are concerned. A few candidates for the ransack flick through his mind. Murphy, or London Centre, may have ordered it after Gabby went off-grid. Riverside could be the culprit, or the guy who stabbed him in the Met Bar may have found the address somehow and come looking for her. Hans punches the keys on the TV remote and drops down to the comms room beneath the flat. His feet create loud, clanging echoes on the metal that bounce around the stairwell. He sits down in the room and logs into the Oberon base layer and on through the Meridian gateway that separates Oberon from the secure servers. Gabby had been forensic in her instructions. Hans follows them to the letter and uploads the USB content, which is encrypted so he cannot see what it is. He then opens an eyes-only container in the secure layer and adds a 72-hour time lock. Finally, he addresses the container to Sir Bernard and copies the one-line message that Gabby left on Psych Carlo. "Here is your mole," it says. Hans wipes the USB stick, backs out through Meridian, and shuts down the session. Whatever was on the USB will be delivered to Sir Bernard under his eyes-only security protocol in 3 days' time. And now the process has started. No one, not even Gabrielle, can stop it. The Golvet restaurant sits 8 floors up above Berlin on Potsdamer Straße in the southwest of the city. Riverside arrives exactly at 9 p.m, as arranged. He asks for a table by the window. He orders a gin and tonic, then watches the traffic negotiate the roads around the park below him, then disappear into the urban sprawl beyond. His drink is halfway down when he turns his head to see Catherine walking towards him through the forest of tables. He gets up and kisses her on both cheeks. She seems pleased to see him, he notices. They try not to reminisce at first, then give in to the temptation, and talk about their last op when they worked together in Italy. Italy's MI6, the AISE, requested resources from the UK to man a major crime operation. Riverside was the British security operations lead, and C9 were brought in to provide sniper cover on 3 occasions for raids on criminal hideouts. Catherine was commended for her work on the operation as she successfully wounded 2 of the top targets that the Italians were after. C9 was unusually present for 3 weeks on the same operation, and Catherine and Riverside talked when they were off duty and shared drinks and food, but hadn't taken it any further, as he wasn't her type, which she told him directly one night, to his apparent amusement.
"So, tell me about this op," she says after a while.
"We're bringing in a rogue agent. Black Hawk. You know her?"
"No. British?"
He nods. "She's off-grid, out of London control," he continues. "The order comes from the highest level. Sir Bernard McIntosh." The waiter brings their starters and the social break allows the words to dissipate. She changes the subject and they talk about where their careers are going. Unlike people in jobs that don't involve lying and death, they both agree that they didn't realize the job they signed up for would remove any vestige of a private life. Riverside is single and ended his relationship with his girlfriend 3 months after joining Six. Catherine says nothing about her relationship, as she is here to forget all about that.
"Can we finish that conversation on the op?"
he says, later in the evening. She nods in agreement. "We're flying out tomorrow."
"Where?"
"You'll find out in the morning."
"Why did you want me on this one?"
she says. "Two heads better than one."
"To do what?"
"Find her."
"And?"
says Catherine. "Bring her in," Riverside says, with an unspoken, obviously, at the end. He gives himself thinking time between her stream of questions by moving a wedge of cheese onto a biscuit and biting into them. She moves her gaze to the window and the German capital that is blue with darkness outside.
"How are you going to bring her in?"
she says. "Don't know yet. Depends on what I find."
"A man with no plan?"
She raises one eyebrow and he smiles. "I have a set of possibilities," he says. "It all depends if she wants to come quietly or not. That's why you're here." Catherine smiles inside at the recognition of her expertise, and she hopes she is hiding the discomfort she feels about an operation against one of their own. "Meet me at Berlin Airport tomorrow, 9 a.m. he says. She raises her glass and he mirrors her action. They chink glasses and drink to their new partnership. Stuart lies in bed and watches the sky through a gap in the top of the blind. Geraldine moves her arm up and across his chest. She feels warm against his skin. A church bell rings in the distance. She asks him what he is thinking. He doesn't know what he's thinking. This is all new to him. They laugh at their past stupidities and the times in their lives when they had felt humbled or just been plain wrong. He hasn't spent his years on the planet trusting people, although he might have done if opportunities had come his way. He asks about her life. She recalls the whole narrative like it had been taught to her. They compare the greatest moments in their lives and the greatest disappointments, or at least the ones she feels comfortable telling him. They pause. The rhetoric ends and it leaves them with thoughts turning on in their minds like the momentum of a vast machine after the power has been cut. They make love a second time in the early hours. After that they sleep. She wakes first, somewhere between 4 and 5 in the morning, and makes tea and toast, then brings it back to bed. A black Mercedes-Benz S600 glides along the motorway through the Bryansk region of Russia, which sits alongside the Ukrainian border. Sebastian Ulrich opens his eyes after sleeping most of the way through the night on the 6-hour journey from Moscow. He looks out of the window at the endless grey of the Russian countryside in the raw dawn. Occasional scattered farms and villages polka dot the barren landscape as the road cuts hard through the desolation. Before the highway was built, this whole region would have been an unforgiving place to journey through. Even though Ulrich grew up in Russia, this territory doesn't bring him any joy. He has no regrets about swapping the biting winds of his homeland for the summer breeze of the Côte d'Azur. They approach a junction that joins their road to the main drag from Oriol and Tula in the east to Kiev in the west in an almost dead straight line. The three-way road layout creates a triangle of land in the center, which houses a cafe and a petrol station. The chauffeur pulls the car off the road and onto the tarmac that surrounds the buildings. Parked on the perimeter of the car park are two 44-ton lorries, painted in a dirty grey, with blue lettering spelling out a fictional haulage company. The driver pulls up next to the wagons and Ulrich steps out. There is a drizzle in the air, and he pulls his unbuttoned coat further around him. The front vehicle's cab door opens. A large man climbs down from the driving seat and makes his way over to where Ulrich stands on the tarmac. He has a slight limp and rubs his hands together as he walks. He reaches out a greasy hand to Sebastian and they shake. The second cab door opens and another man gets out, this time tall and thin, but no less worn by a life of thundering along the roads of Europe. The three men huddle together as the rain whips up in the wind, then hits the side of each truck with a whining groan. After they talk for 5 minutes, Ulrich turns and waves his arm in the direction of another 44-tonner parked up 50 yards away. This new lorry starts its engine and drives towards the other vehicles, then turns and backs into the first two. Four men emerge from the third vehicle. One breaks the seals on the juggernaut, and they swing open the back doors as the new driver inches the lorries closer until there is less than a foot between the back ends. The men drop a metal sheet across to form a bridge and begin to drag and push crates from the third lorry into each of the first two in turn. 40 minutes later, in which time Ulrich retreats the warmth of his Mercedes, the transfer is complete. Sebastian clambers out and inspects the work, while the men stand in a semicircle, waiting for his imperial approval. He turns and gives a thumbs up. One man produces a bottle of vodka, and they all swig from it. Ulrich tells the men they need to drive non-stop, so we'll need two drivers in each vehicle. After some haggling amongst the gang, the men regroup themselves, then walk back to the vehicles and all climb aboard. Ulrich waits in the rain while the engines roar into life, and black clouds of exhaust belch off across the surrounding terrain. The third lorry heads back into the Russian heartland, and the other two growl onto the road and turn left for the Ukrainian border with their mislabeled agricultural machinery.